the weight of history enlightens and sometimes burdens. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you a novel idea. 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and no time like now to reflect on Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, mother of John Quincy Adams, and some call her our founding mother. Later in the show, we'll visit with Stephanie Dre and Laura Kamoy, whose historical fiction, A Founding Mother, paints a picture of a strong, intelligent, and influential voice during the American Revolution and beyond. Coming up, we'll visit with Ziva Bukai, whose novel is The World Between, the story of an actress of the Yiddish theater whose childhood spent in a Siberian camp remains with her and whose failed marriage further unravels her right into a Tel Aviv sanatorium. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Ziva Bukai is a prize-winning author whose novel, The Anatomy of Exile, is a winner of the National Jewish Book Award, and her current novel, The World Between, is equally praised. It is the story of a once-famous actress of the Yiddish theater who travels from New York to Tel Aviv in the wake of her marriage's failure. She finds herself in a sanatorium run by a group of nuns and pieces together just how she got there. The persistent nature of childhood war trauma, something that permeates many peoples, cultures, and epochs, is at the center of her strife. Here is my conversation with Ziva Bukai. This is a story of loss at its deepest level. Our narrator is an actress from the Yiddish theater, and we find her in Israel in a psychiatric, I'll call it a psychiatric institution, where she's being treated. And the novel takes the epistolary form of her writing to her estranged husband, a playwright and theater director. And so we hear this whole story through her voice, kind of talking to her husband. And so I wonder why you alighted on this form.
I wanted some aspect of real immediacy. And when I landed on this idea of writing a letter to her husband to try to explain why she's in this place, in the Sisters of the St. Joseph of the Apparition Hospice, which is really a kind of sanitarium, I thought, I just wanted that sense of urgency, because everything about her felt very urgent to me. She needed to get this down. She needed a record of what was happening to her. And also, this was a way for her to piece together the events that got her to this particular moment.
We don't meet any of the other characters except through her. We get to know some about her husband and a little bit more about Rothman, a lifelong companion of hers, and some of the people around her in this hospice. So talk a little bit about these characters, about her, and about these critical people in her life.
Sure. So this is an unnamed narrator. She is a former Yiddish actress of the stage in New York City. She had been an actress also in Israel when she was there in her youth, in her late teens, early 20s. She gets to Israel after the Second World War, which she and Rothman spend in a children's home in a Siberian gulag. And when she finds herself in the sanitarium, the people that we meet are, of course, her husband, Max, who, as you said earlier, is a playwright. And they were kind of the Yiddish power couple in the what used to be known as the Jewish Rialto in New York City, the Second Avenue Yiddish theaters. And Max is someone she has a complicated relationship with. She talks about that complicated relationship in the course of the novel. The person who is kind of the love of her life, even though she loves Max very much, the love of her life is really Rothman. She knows Rothman from her childhood. He basically saved her life in the Gulag. And then, of course, when they after the war, when they're going through Poland and trying to find their relatives who are all dead, they go to Israel together. They live together in Israel, in on the Street of Shoes, in the apartment she later shares with her husband Max. Rothman is a scrounger. He's a survivor, and he helped her survive. And he's quite a character. And then, of course, there's Dr. S, who is her psychiatrist. And in the course of her sessions with him, she begins to remember different times of her life. And while she might not necessarily tell Dr. S about it, she about those events, they certainly rise to the surface in her letter to Max. There is Thomas Henrik, who Thomas Henrik, actually, who is another patient in this hospital, who she winds up having a relationship with. Thomas Henrik reminds her of a childhood friend that she and Rothman had, which is why she calls him Thomas. His real name is Henrik. And he is someone also who has experienced loss in the Second World War and is suffering post-traumatic stress disorder at this point in his life. And then, of course, there's Sister Francoise, who is one of the nuns in the sanitarium, who she has also a kind of complicated relationship with. And then I guess the final person would be the Georgian caretaker. Another woman who takes care of her, who reminds her of someone that she knew in the Siberian Gulag during the Second World War. I don't know whether your audience knows that there were a lot of Polish Jews and a lot of Polish non-Jews who were deported to Siberia for the Soviet war effort.
And that's something that I found an interesting aspect of the book, that so often in a story like this that is recounting people who have survived displacement during World War II, and they're coming from different environments, you know, the camps, or maybe they were children hidden away in France or something. And so I found that the experience of her and Rothman in Siberia was a different aspect to that. And is this something that your family has experienced as well?
So my mother was actually born in Orsk. My grandparents and my uncle, who was about 6 years old at the time, they were deported. They began their lives in Krzyżnowiec in Poland, which is right next to Lodz. And I think that they moved east in order to avoid the Germans. But then they met up with the Russians, and the Russians deported them to Orsk, which is right on the Siberian border. My grandmother was pregnant at the time. She gave birth in Orsk, and I think that they were later moved further into Siberia. My mother grew up in a children's home the first 5 years of her life. My grandmother could only see her once a week because she was forced to labor as a laundress in the basically in Siberia. You know, she would tell us stories about my uncle stealing, yet she would give him soap that he would then take. He would stand out the window and she would pass, you know, laundry soap to him, which they were later able to sell on the black market for extra food. My mother, on the other hand, grew up in a children's home. That was one of the things that I really wanted to explore here. And I keep circling around this because I'm actually writing something else right now, which I seem to also be looking at this idea of what it means to grow up in a children's home, in a kind of orphanage with people who might be rather indifferent to you. My mother, the only story my mother ever told me about the children's home was that her head was shaved every week. Every single week, there would be a matron who would come and shave their heads. They would stand in line in their underwear, and they would have their heads shaved. And something about that image I found very chilling and rattling. And so that was something that I discussed in this book as well. So I do have this history, but they hardly spoke about it. And in order for me to process it, it was something that I needed to imagine.
So you took shards of that experience of your mother's and wove it into this story.
And the way that I kind of think of this story is if it were, I have this image in my mind of a large plate and just dropping it from a height and seeing all the shards and then thinking about how do I put all of these different aspects of life and history into a complete picture. And there is this sense of the fragmented and the shattered about this particular narrator as well. I mean, the history itself is diasporic and it's complex and it is shattering and difficult for us to kind of comprehend at this moment in time of what that must have been like.
We say that, how difficult it is to comprehend, and it remains so. The human condition is one of loss. It is inevitable, but certain experiences are devastating and more searing than others. The loss of a child, the persecution based on where you were born, and this story is about loss in humanity and displacement. Particularly during World War II and the indelible effects of those who suffered. And globally, this is still happening. Mothers and fathers losing their children, losing their homes, and refugees in a world that is less and less willing to absorb them and their stories.
I'm not sure that it's any more or less now that people or, that countries are willing to absorb. I mean, I do know that most especially in terms of World War II, most especially in terms of Jewish refugees, no one wanted them. They were sent back. They were sent back to Germany. I mean, when we think about that, I don't know that we've actually moved forward. There are times, I think, in peacetime where immigrants are absorbed more. But when we see war and upheaval, I think that borders get shut down. I mean, it's really frightening when you think about it. It seems to me globally that life is about this kind of upheaval and displacement. I mean, certainly it was that way in the second half of the 20th century, right? But even the 21st century, we see all of this upheaval and this movement and displacement of large swaths of people. I mean, it's really heartbreaking. And I think that the book kind of gets at that as well as at how traumatic displacement is, the wrenching from parents. And I think one of the things that I was really trying to get at here was childhood war trauma, which I don't know that we see enough of, that we really understand how it affects children and then later how it affects adult, them in adulthood.
It never goes away.
Right. It never does. It stays with them forever. I mean, I know survivors that seemed perfectly fine in their midlife. They gave birth to children, they had families, their kids were doing well, they were doing well. And suddenly, at a certain point in their older years, they begin to suffer PTSD and have flashbacks and hallucinations and nightmares. And all sorts of things, and they really begin to kind of lose their marbles, right? They're no longer themselves. That center does not hold.
And that is the case with our character.
Yes.
She's in her, mid to late 60s at the time of this story. And as an actress, she has played Medea and Jocasta, but it is her role in a play written by her husband, of the Blue Lady,
That's right.
that she comes back to this again and again. And the exact story of that play is not articulated as much as her experience of it. So talk about that a little bit.
Yes. So her husband, Max, writes a play called Die Bleue Dame, which is basically The Blue Lady. And he writes it for her. The way he writes all of his plays are basically for her to act. He writes these, important female characters. And this one, he writes as a kind of condemnation, retribution for what he feels she has done. And I don't want to give too much away, but the play is devastating to her. It is about a woman who loves the color indigo, and everything she wears is indigo. And she's a woman who is obsessed with this color and has her servants actually dye their children's limbs and bodies in this blue dye. It is a horrifying image. A lot of it is based on Max's own experience of a woman. He himself was in a concentration camp in Germany. And there was a woman who would ride her horse. Her horse would have these blue plumes, and she would dress in a blue riding outfit. And she would pass by and she would pick cherries from the trees and eat them while the inmates would watch her and they were starving. This is actually an image that I took from my grandfather's experience, well, actually, my step grandfather's experience in a concentration camp in Germany. He would tell this story about this woman who would ride her horse. She was very wealthy, and she would eat these cherries and then would throw them at the inmates, and they would scramble to pick up the cherries and eat them because they were starving. Again, this is like an image from my family that I put into the book because it was something that really stayed with me. But the fact that Max has her play the Blue Lady is devastating for the narrator because it brings up tremendous loss in her life and this condemnation of what Max perceives as her fault.
And she's lauded for this role. Others think she's brilliant. At the same time, it's devastating for her.
Yes, exactly. And of course, that's the great irony here, right? She plays this character so well because in essence, she feels she is playing her life. She is playing herself. And it is probably the closest character to herself that is so devastating to her. And Max captures that. And she finds it unforgivable that he's done so. And this is part of the, I think, complexity of their marriage.
They had been living in New York, but they separate. She goes back to Tel Aviv, where this apartment that they lived in years and years ago, it hasn't been lived in since they moved away. And this setting is where she has her rupture from reality. And there's something ghostly about this setting, and also, Ziva, a bit theatrical.
Yes, true, but it's actually a real place. It is on the Street of Shoes. There is a street in Tel Aviv, or at least there used to be a street in Tel Aviv. The name of the street is actually Neve Sha'anan. It was called the Street of Shoes. And the reason is because back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, all the way, I think, to probably the early 80s, there used to be shoe factories, small shoe factories on that street. And they would have the shoe factories would then have the storefront where they would sell the shoes that they would be making in the back. So this is where shoes were sold and made. It was always an enclave for immigrants, different waves of immigrants. And in the 2000s, it became a place where there had been Ethiopian Jews who had lived there, and then people from Eritrea, people from Sudan. And so this place was, it was really kind of down and out. It is now the old bus central bus station, but back, all the way again from like probably the 20s through the 90s, it was the Tel Aviv central bus station, and then a new central bus station was created very close to this one. It was a strange place where there was a market and there was these buses coming and going, and you would see people like on Friday afternoons before the Sabbath, they'd be carrying live chickens in cages that would then be their Sabbath meal, right? I mean, it was this strange, dramatic, and theatrical place where people would be yelling, and you would hear Arabic music, and you would hear Israeli music, and you would have religious men trying to get Jewish men to put on phylacteries, tefillin, and say prayers. You would see women with packages, loaded down with packages from the marketplace, people coming and going. It was noisy and dirty and loud, and there was something quite spectacular about it.
Yet when she enters that apartment after years and years, I don't know, it characterizes her and then her behavior moving forward is eventually what does land her in this hospice. Ziva, you, I believe, have been an actress or studied acting, and how much did that contribute to or is inflected in this story?
So I think quite a bit. I studied acting and was involved in acting and theater for about 10 years. And I studied acting actually in Israel. And I had some amazing teachers. One of them was this guy, Binyamin Tzemach, or Benjamin Tzemach, who was the brother of Natan Tzemach. Natan Tzemach was one of the founders of Habima Theater. This was back in the early 20s. He and his troupe of Jewish actors from Moscow came to what was then Palestine and established Habima, which then became the National Theater of Israel. Binyamin Tzemach, meanwhile, went to the United States and was part of the explosion of Yiddish theater here in the US, in New York. And he was not only an actor, but he was a choreographer. And he actually was able to transfer into Hollywood and Broadway. And he was really quite a name at that time. He worked with Martha Graham. He worked with many, many people. And then he went back to Israel. And while he was there, and he was pretty old at that time, he was my teacher for a short period of time. And he was really a character. Max is based on him a little bit. Not that Binyamin was a playwright, but just the way he looked. He had these sharp blue eyes. At the time, he had white hair when I knew him, but I imagined him as a blonde. But he wore this fedora, this black fedora, rakishly angled on his head with a black cape. And he was quite a theatrical character. And so Max was kind of based on him a little bit. The acting also came into the way that this narrator processed the world. She is someone who puts on different personas. It is where she's comfortable. She is most comfortable play acting someone else, not necessarily herself. And so that became something that was very important. And then, in terms of my own writing craft, I really employ a lot of acting techniques in terms of creating character, kind of creating character both in terms of interiority and the exterior life of the character, their physicality, the way they behave. So all of that really comes into play. This idea of what to hold back, that was something that I remember from my acting days, where I remember teachers telling me that when you have a very emotional scene, instead of letting it all out there, to actually pull back and hold in what you can, that it becomes more powerful in that sense. And so that was also something that I tried to do here with her, that when we get to a very emotional moment, that she draws back and kind of holding the reins in order to create that dramatic tension.
Well, I think you have employed that quite effectively in the book. I mean, the book is concise. It's not an overly long book. Some have called it a novella. The book is concise with as much unsaid as said. And that brings the reader in at kind of a different level of engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that what the reader is seeing, first of all, that this is a three-dimensional character, and that what we're seeing her go through, my hope is that the reader is experiencing not exactly what she's going through, but that there is a level of compassion for what she's going through, that we see a depth in her that isn't necessarily stated on the page. And that is what is creating that tension that makes you want to turn the page. And I also think that we're all mysterious. We're all unknowable. We certainly don't say everything that we're thinking, right? She says quite a bit, but there's so much that she holds back, so much that she can't bear to process.
Ziva Bukai, The World Between is the book. And before we say goodbye, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your writing life and habits.
I try to write every day. Sometimes it's 15 minutes, and sometimes it can be a few hours. This is my second book. My first book was The Anatomy of Exile. I have been writing for the last 30 years. My first book took me 10 years to write and 6 years to publish. So this is a long journey. And The World Between took a shorter period of time because it is definitely a shorter book. I started writing seriously late in life, and it became a great passion of mine. And I think that most especially at this time, writing these stories feels very important to me because this is a generation that is basically, almost gone. And so these stories feel poignant and important, and they resonate for me on many different levels, both in a sense of keeping my family history alive, but also this history alive. And I think history that a lot of people don't know about. I mean, there's a lot of Holocaust literature out there, but I think that the Siberian aspect of this is something that we don't hear a lot about. I don't think we hear a lot of stories about refugees where they have had no other place to go but to Israel. And I think those are stories that feel pertinent at the moment.
Ziva, thanks so much for talking with us today. All the best.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate the opportunity to do so, and I hope listeners who read The World Between enjoy it, and they are more than welcome to reach out to me. Thank you so much.
My conversation with Ziva Bukai and her gripping book is The World Between. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. We'll take a short break before switching lanes to talk about Abigail Adams, a founding mother. We'll be right back. I am Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Abigail Adams, wife of one president and mother of another, was a woman ahead of her time, yet caught in her time. Best-selling authors Stephanie Dre and Laura Kamoy have their own writing careers, but together they are rather amazing. Their fourth collaboration is the historical fiction A Founding Mother, about the life of the second First Lady of the United States, Abigail Adams. Dre is a best-selling author of historical fiction whose work has been translated into 8 languages, and Kamoy, also an author, is a historian of American history and taught at the U.S. Naval Academy. Their writing projects together have yielded 4 books with a seamless voice that makes for a deep and informed read. Here's my conversation with Stephanie Dre and Laura Kamoy on A Founding Mother, a novel of Abigail Adams.
The two of you have written books alone, but you also have collaborated frequently. I was so intrigued because of the consistency of the language, and the language is something that I want to talk about because it really does capture the voice of a different time. I had to look up things that turned out to be alcoholic dessert beverages and different types of fashion accessories. But there is a cadence to the narration, which is in the voice of Abigail. So it's not a contemporary voice, and it's sometimes hard to say why. So how do you pick that sort of thing up? Is it from period writing and letters? Or talk about how you get that consistent voice and how you found Abigail's voice.
We always start with the primary sources. And in Abigail's case, we were very fortunate. There are over 1,200 digitized letters on the founders.archives.gov site, and any American can access them. And so we try to use Abigail's own words as much as we can. And then, of course, you have to modernize it a little bit because 18th century prose is pretty dense and it's difficult for a modern ear. So Laura and I will often slip into what we affectionately call old-timey language, which is a very scientific term. But what we mean by it is that we are using her language and her cadence, but we're smoothing it out as much as we can for the modern reader, wherever they might get tripped up. When we are speaking about Abigail's voice, there's her literal voice, the things that she said. There's the way that we layered it and made it more accessible. But the overall impression of her voice is extremely modern. And I think readers are going to love getting to know her because Abigail had something to say. And of the entire founding generation, I think she's the figure who speaks most resonantly to us today.
I wonder how historical fiction, like the works that the two of you approach, differs from a biography, from the reader's perspective, from the writer's perspective. And your afterword explains where you took some license. And then I think about the conversations between the characters, too. So talk a little bit about historical fiction that I want to say it is something we can trust, even though it's called historical fiction.
Historical fiction and biography are trying to do some similar things and some different things. Biography is usually, though not in every case, but usually limited by what is known. Sometimes there's speculation, but usually not all the way to the point of dramatization, which then starts to take it more into what is sometimes called narrative nonfiction. And I think there's a lot of connections between narrative nonfiction and historical fiction. In historical fiction, you're not only telling the story of the person, you are creating an arc that tells a particular story, very much based in the source material, but that you are shaping to tell the emotional story that you want to tell. What we do, it is so grounded in the historical record that I think our novels do make historical contributions, but we take licenses and liberties dramatically that a biographer is not going to take, in part because in a novel, you're in the character's first person experience. You're in their head, you're in their thoughts. And no amount of records, even by the about the most documented person, is ever going to give you that kind of an insight into their lives.
You want to know that a biography is grounded in fact, less than speculation. A novel is trying to give an emotional experience. And for us in particular, knowing that we are dealing with founding figures, we are very careful with what we change and we document what we change. And that's why we have a very long author's note where we explain what was fact, what was fiction, what are educated guesses, what we think is true based on the evidence that we have, what we're not sure is true. And I think anytime you come across really good historical fiction with a meaty author's note, you can feel pretty confident.
The book follows the Adams family from before the American Revolution right through late in life. They were married for over 50 years. And in telling the story, it reveals a different facet of this period of time. And both Abigail and her husband John were thoughtful people. But we might call Abigail, we might call her a proto-feminist, or at least an advocate for women being heard and counted. You said you thought she was one of the most significant figures of that period of time. So let's establish Abigail Adams.
I think she can be certainly called a proto-feminist. I don't think it would be wrong to call her a feminist even, except that that term is associated with more modern movements that grew out of work that women in the 18th century already started during the, let's say, the French Revolution and before. Abigail was herself very independent of mind, noticeably so even when she was a child. And John Adams knew what he was getting when he married her. And I think that's sort of delightful. They always had a way of speaking to each other with great candor. And she was increasingly not just his support in terms of economics by supporting the farm and raising the children and running a business that enabled his career as a founding father, but eventually became his greatest political advisor, which I don't think people talk about enough, because he had a cabinet that he had inherited from George Washington, who he did not trust. Those men were all loyal to Alexander Hamilton, who was a protagonist of one of our other novels. We like him less in this novel. Abigail certainly liked him less. And so John had to turn to her for advice. And she remained in the political mix to the point where the public accepted it, sometimes teased that she was actually the one in charge. And when John would do things that they didn't agree with, they might say, well, if the old woman had been in Philadelphia, she'd have never let this happen. So that's Abigail Adams. She was at the forefront of the revolution, and it was our honor to write about her.
You just mentioned Alexander Hamilton, and there are lots of other patriots and politicians threaded through the story. Prominent among them were Alexander Hamilton and also Thomas Jefferson, who they had a long and eventually fairly bumpy friendship. And yeah, she had very strong feelings about these people. And I think it's, for us, the reader, probably pretty healthy to have these perspectives.
Well, one of the things that we, I think, really feel is useful and important about our novels is that in all of these cases, we've taken these founding mothers and founding fathers who seem remote and monumental and made them more relatable mothers, fathers, and people who were trying to make the best often of very difficult situations. And hopefully that allows them to become more relatable and accessible to readers in all of the cases of our novels. In terms of Jefferson, I mean, he was always, even when we were writing his novel, a difficult person to get to the heart of the man. And I think some of that comes out in the friendship between the Adams and Thomas Jefferson as well. I think he could sometimes intellectualize conflicts and ideas to an extent that he did not always anticipate or perhaps appreciate the emotional impact it might have on those around him. We found this even in his relationship with his own daughter when we wrote America's First Daughter. And so what starts out as a relationship of a great deal of respect and camaraderie and closeness as their political views diverge with the creation and founding of the new nation, they begin to encounter differences of opinion about which their friendship cannot overcome. And it's not until later in life when they sort of find one another again, you know, at that point being some of the last surviving members of the revolutionary generation.
What I like about their relationship and what was really fun to put on the page is that the Adamses are very blunt, honest people. And the Jeffersons are the opposite of this. The Jeffersons are courtly and stately and super passive aggressive. They don't want to make waves. They don't want to have an open confrontation. And so what this creates is a situation where John Adams always feels like Jefferson has lied to him. He's not sensing that Jefferson's trying to be polite or get out of a situation. And sometimes Jefferson is lying to him. John Adams seems incapable almost of lying, much to his detriment. So there's a mismatch of personalities. Abigail is sort of at the middle. She's capable of telling a fib if need be, but she thinks that Jefferson is so smart and brilliant and charming, and then thinks he's slippery and easily falls to the praise of the masses. And there are some real hurt feelings that come up between them because they went through a great deal of difficulty together, hand in hand, during the revolution. And to see that friendship fall apart, it's very painful, but it also was delicious to write about, especially when Abigail takes up her own pen in secret to write to Thomas Jefferson, who is now president, and argue with him, take him to task behind her husband's back. That's one of the best correspondences that we found in the original letters.
You know, she also sometimes gritted her teeth and maybe just smiled or something to kind of preserve a certain decorum or maybe avoid creating a scene.
Certainly. And she did that much better than her husband, who was, as they said, testy.
But they had an amazing love story. But before he became vice president and then president, he was doing a lot of work away from home. In fact, they were separated for years at a time and even had two of their sons with him for part of that time as well. So this probably served their oldest son, John Quincy, well, but it left Abigail bereft and at times even a little bitter. So talk about that sacrifice that they made as a family for a big part of their lives.
This is, I think, one of the things that really comes up in all of our novels is the degree of familial sacrifice that the Revolutionary era demanded of these founding families. And it was possibly never more true than in the case of the Adams, where they spent probably a cumulative 10 to 12 years separated by John's various commitments. And, you know, the Revolution was very much Abigail's enterprise, Abigail's fight as well. She was a woman who, by disposition, was pretty independent minded. But the circumstances of John's offices and commitments meant that she was also independent by necessity. That led her to become an entrepreneur. It led her to become, in many instances, a single parent. It led her to demand things of John, sort of that she needed to make that life possible. And it did impose difficulties on their relationship, which really was a true love story. But that doesn't mean that there aren't difficulties. And one of the things that's special about this novel is that you see how they grapple through these challenging times to get to a place of even deeper mutual respect, even deeper love, and sort of a mature romance that recognizes the sacrifices that both parties have made. And that's one of the things I think about the Adams that is so relatable.
You just mentioned that she had to be resourceful and was resourceful, and she became a clever and successful entrepreneur and was able to amass a degree of wealth to a point where she became the person in the family who truly handled their finances. And it all seemed to start with sewing pins and needles.
Yes, there is a song in the musical 1776 where Abigail is asking about pins. And I never really understood the import of that till we started writing this novel. And I realized that pins were the start of her business career. She got pin money for herself by selling pins when they were a jealously guarded resource during the American Revolution. And this is what she did to help keep her children fed and to keep the farm going when John was overseas or his pay was very slow or sometimes non-existent. And so that evolved from pins into gloves and lace handkerchiefs and ribbons and things like that, that Abigail had a real eye for, that she would ask John to send her from Europe. And she was even willing to take a lot of risks because a lot of those shipments were sunk. This was a war, a world war, really. And so it was very difficult to get shipments across the sea safely. But she did the math and decided that she could still profit even if a number of her shipments were lost to the bottom of the sea. And so that's the kind of person she was. She really was a risk taker.
And she had people she worked with who, because at that time, women could do very little outside of their husband doing it, like buying property. And she was fairly astute, and she developed the type of partnerships, let's say, that allowed her to succeed.
Yes, she was a true entrepreneur. She worked her relationships and partnerships. She traveled to sell things. She dedicated space within her home to storing her products and organizing her business. And one of my favorite things about Abigail is that with this wealth, she was able to write a will, which is not very typical for women of this era, and to leave that wealth to the other women in her life so that they would have the financial independence that would give them true independence if and when they needed it in their lives.
Abigail, she had strong feelings about slavery and about owning other people. And in fact, that Adams had no slaves and they paid wages to those who worked for them. And she really wanted these freedoms along with the acknowledgement of women being more deeply embedded in the founding documents. But they were not. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this.
So Abigail and John were both opponents of slavery. And we don't know exactly how or why Abigail developed her opposition to slavery, though there was certainly a strong strain against it in Massachusetts, where she was born and raised. But there is a person in Abigail's life that I cannot wait for readers to meet. And her name is Phoebe Abdy. She was an enslaved woman by Abigail's father and seems to have raised in part Abigail and her sisters. She was freed in consequence of the Constitution in Massachusetts that John Adams wrote. It was interpreted to outlaw slavery, and so Phoebe was given her freedom in Abigail's father's will. And yet, that was not the end of the relationship. Phoebe and Abigail remained friends. They remained close. They had a complicated relationship, but a very close one where they celebrated holidays together. Abigail hosted Phoebe's wedding. She took care of Phoebe at the end of her life, personally nursing her. And she grieved the loss of this woman. And we couldn't help but think that this had to have a profound influence on Abigail. And something that we know about Phoebe from the historical record is that she was extremely generous to the point where she was constantly helping girls in Braintree and Quincy who were in trouble or impoverished, formerly enslaved girls or white girls, servants, anyone who was met with misfortune, she would help, even though it irritated the Adamses and other people because she was just letting strangers into the house. And to think about this woman having a formative relationship with Abigail tells you maybe where Abigail got some of her compassion and where she may have formed some of her beliefs against slavery.
So today we hear of the Alien and Sedition Acts, but it was controversial at the time too. Talk a little bit about its inception. It was opposed by many, including Thomas Jefferson, who, when he became president, he repealed three of the four acts, with only the Alien Enemies Act remaining, which has been invoked usually, I'll say usually, during wartime. And this was really a point of contention between Adams and other politicians, notably Jefferson.
What I would say is that this is not Abigail Adams' shining moment.
No.
When I say that she was very influential, this is one example where she was tremendously influential and it had a bad result. She did favor these laws. There are reasons that she favored them. She thought they were war exigencies only, and that they would never be used in any other way. And she, of course, thought, well, my husband would never abuse these powers. Personally, I think she was wrong about this and that we may have paid a bad price for it, but Laura may have her own take on it.
No, I agree. This was not her finest moment. And I think that's important to show because the purpose of these novels is not to put them on a pedestal, but to show the way that they tried to grapple through the challenges of building a new nation. And also, frankly, to show the ways in which we continue to live and grapple with the decisions that they made in the past and how very relevant all of these kinds of things are. The context was, you know, concerns over national security in the context of the later years of the French Revolution and the entry into the United States of lots of French refugees. And the ways that that was enhancing the political factionalism of the day. And all of that is very relatable, as is the fact that, you know, sort of the target of the laws were immigrants and people who were born in other places. And those are legacies that we continue to deal with today.
And newspapermen. Yes. Lots and lots of them were punished under the Sedition Act. Actually, I should correct that. Some were punished under the Sedition Act, and Abigail had strong feelings about that, too. She thought some of them deserved it.
Right. She didn't like what they were saying about her husband.
That's right.
Mark Twain is credited with saying history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so much of what is happening in our very moment can be seen and understood through the lens of our country's messy founding, just as we're talking about. And several times during the book, I couldn't help but to think of this very day.
We feel that often when we're writing. You know, we'll be writing about something that happened 250 years ago, and it's literally the same issue that's in the news that day. And it's striking just how relevant the Revolutionary Era continues to be.
And this being the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, this book seemed especially relevant to us. And also hearing Abigail's voice and seeing these events through her eyes gave us some steadiness about how we go about approaching the celebration of this event. Because I know Americans are grappling with what does it mean to be American? What is the national mission anymore? And I think it's important for us to look back to the start and take a really deep look at it. Not just the slogans and the jargon and the setting off of fireworks, though the Adamses were great fans of fireworks, but the meaning behind the words and behind their actions and what that instructs us to do in our current moment to be good citizens.
I think we're all grateful for your work, and I thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This has been really lovely.
Yes, thank you.
Stephanie Dre and Laura Camoy. The book is A Founding Mother, a novel of Abigail Adams. Earlier, I spoke with Ziva Bukai on her book, The World Between. These books couldn't be more different in theme and substance, yet they both bring the lasting weight of history to us in compelling ways. I am Suzanne Lang. Our music is from Peter Jacobson. I have production assistance from Mark Prell, Kelly Olson, Nico Wyckoff, and sometimes Max Allen. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at norcalpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.